You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila, delicious and smooth tequila, made in harmony with the earth. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Max McKinnon. We'll talk to Max about food, wine, pizza, burgers, and more. We'll taste a Tricot Pinot Noir Rosé for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Hailing from California, with time spent in Vermont, Max McKinnon found a love for cooking and attended the French Culinary Institute after graduating college in Vermont. He crisscrossed the country working in San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Hudson, New York, his own restaurant, Pisto, in Vermont, and even worked in Copenhagen. Max always had a love for wine and morphed over to wine sales, eventually leaving to hit the floor as wine director at Roberta's Pizza in New York, previously at Roberta's in Culver City. We are here in Bushwick at the Heritage Radio Studios. Max, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Like I said, we're talking to Max from our Heritage Radio Studios at Roberta's Pizza in two truck containers in the back of the restaurant. So that ambient noise you hear in the background, people enjoying pizza and Max's wine selections. Max, it's kind of a tradition on the Grape Nation that we have the wine guy from Roberta's on. That's why I chased you down.
Sure.
Because we're in and out of here so much. We've had Amanda Smeltz on. We had Hugh Crickmore on. Kirk Sutherland.
Yeah.
I don't think there was anyone in between.
It sounds like you hit the
And then you, Max McKinnon. So it's good to sit down with you. Let's assume not everyone knows everything about you.
Most people don't, I'm sure.
Okay. I'm trying to be delicate, man.
Right.
So give me a little background on your journey in food, life, and wine that got you here today, you know, which is in Brooklyn at Roberta's. And it's pretty rich, you know, so I want you to cut.
Oh, sure.
Your angle is interesting because a lot of people fell in love with wine or came from wine. You know, get me started at the appropriate place to start.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of fell in love with wine through food, kind of after food. So at some point in college, I got very interested in cooking and yeah, that just became kind of an
obsession.
But
how does that happen? You're in college. You're at Middlebury in Vermont.
Yeah.
You know, great state. Pretty good food culture, natural
sure.
food and all that. But, you know, not the biggest restaurant thing. How does that happen?
I think I fell into it through just loving to host people. Even in college, my mother was living, you know, less than an hour away in Burlington.
Good town.
So every once in a while, I'd get a couple of friends and drive up and eventually just started making dinner for whatever reason. It felt right to be.
And you felt you had a good command of preparing
Not, not early on, but I think I picked it up maybe quicker than most. It felt a little more natural. Then it was buying cookbooks, and then it was just sitting there reading them instead of reading textbooks at school.
Fair to say, like, a mild obsession with it?
Yeah, I think That's a good way to put it.
All right, so was I correct in saying that when you graduated college, you took those interests and went to culinary school?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
Pretty much right away.
So everything really gelled and you decided, let me take this to the next level.
Yeah. I had some pretty fun and interesting and challenging experiences while I was in New York. Challenging only in that were often very long days, and I was going to school at night, working during the day, working some nights when I was off
at
school.
You had to juggle everything.
Yeah, so...
when you decided to go to cooking school, did you have a focus? Like French cooking, Italian cooking, pastries?
I think I was generally drawn to French cooking.
For you?
Yeah.
French culinary.
Right. That made sense.
Yeah.
And
so when you go there, is it like classically trained? They sort of take the French cooking thing and...
Right. You learn kind of the brigade system and your mother sauces and kind of everything from there on.
So very classic.
Yeah.
Do you finish the program?
I did. It was 9 months, so it was pretty...
Intensive?
Yeah, but not too crazy.
Okay.
It was kind of a, you know, there were some people who came maybe out of high school, but most people had either had another job and they were switching industries or they came after college or whatever.
But were you one of the older guys there? I mean, you're not an old guy per se.
I was kind of in between.
In the middle, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So while you're there, obviously you realize it's going to come to an end. What are you thinking about, you know, doing? What are you going to do? I mean...
I had, after college, moved right down to the city, and a friend of mine in school did the same, and she was working, and I was in school and working, and kind of during our free time, if we were interested in going out to some restaurant that we probably shouldn't be able to afford, or she was always the one I called. So we actually both decided to move back to Vermont after a year in the city. So
what was that part of the plan or just things got too intense or too expensive? Or
I felt maybe drawn to the food scene because I'd had a little bit of an experience in it and thought there were a couple of people I could go back and work for.
What year is this?
This is 2011.
Okay. So you go to school in New York, you finally head back to Vermont. What happens there?
I was looking for a job. She found a job and was serving in downtown Burlington. And I reached out to the few people I thought I could work with and never heard back. And
thanks a lot.
We ended up, somebody put us in touch with a real estate guy and... We found a little 33-seat restaurant, and
it was set up as a restaurant?
It was, yeah. I mean, we did a little work on it, but for whatever reason, we decided to make the crazy.
So that was Pisto?
Yeah.
And was it called Pisto then, or you named it Pisto?
It was in a Spanish restaurant,
okay.
And then we decided to call it Pisto. Yeah.
So you're not up there that long, and you find a property?
Yeah. So,
and the two of you jump into this?
We did. She ran the front of house, and I was in the kitchen.
So you had to think quick about a vision. I mean, what was your...
Yeah, I mean, it was very seasonal and like focused on local produce and meat and, you know, seafood as well, but with a lean towards French cooking.
Was it easy to... procure ingredients up there?
It was. You know, in the winter you get used to cooking the same thing,
it's
or
limited.
The same produce at least. And you try and get creative with it, but at least the quality was there.
So you go up to Vermont. Is this really your first gig? Was there anything in between?
Essentially, yeah.
Right. So how long are you're owners of the restaurant?
Yeah.
How long are you operating the restaurant for?
3 years. She was there for a year and then left, and I was there for two more.
was it a decent go? I mean,
it was
a successful. Was acclaimed in much more local papers and all that, magazines?
We were nominated for a James Beard Award. We were like,
it's impressive.
I mean, it was shocking, honestly, but I woke
up. I
was 25 years old.
That's the shocking part, not your ability or your effort in the food. It's just, you know, how quickly it happened.
Right.
All right, so let's keep moving along. So you're up and open for about 3 years.
And then after about 8 months, I started buying the wine for the restaurant. So that's kind of where the wine journey starts.
Okay, we'll come back. I want to come back to that. Why does Pisto come to an end?
I just was very tired. And
literally from the crazy hours and the heat and the stress.
And I was the only owner operator. And it was a tiny little restaurant on a corner in Burlington, Vermont. And I was like, I feel like there's more.
Yeah. But don't you for a moment say, holy shit, this is what I chose to do for the rest of my life. Now I'm nervous. Or you didn't think that way?
No, I still
you just
had enough energy and had enough.
Okay.
Or at least, you know, knew the passion was still there.
So is it fair to say that the restaurant established you as a legitimate restaurant guy, chef, and all that? I mean, a James Beard nomination, you know, real stuff.
Right.
So you closed the restaurant because you had it. And then there's a fairly interesting journey of you traveling around. So, you know, take me through those locations.
It started with a brief stint in Hudson, New York. I was there just for a summer helping out at Zach Palacio's fishing game.
He was one of the first guys up there.
Or
one of the first big name guys.
And then from there, just a few months in Copenhagen. You know, I didn't have a visa, so.
Where were you in Copenhagen?
A restaurant called Relay. And I cooked there for 6 weeks and then worked on with their wine import company for 6 weeks. And then after that, came back.
Wait, stop for a sec. When you're in Copenhagen, are things so much different there? It's not that you'd been in the business for like 20 years,
right.
But you know, you had your own place.
Yeah.
You were up with Zach, you know, at Hudson for a little bit. Is it different there? I mean, do they just see it and do it differently, or it's the same but different?
I think it's pretty different.
Is it?
Yeah, it gave me a very interesting and at least unique to me perspective.
Important to your future as far as how you...
I think so. I'm sure. Yeah. I think it has an impact on the way I look at restaurants and wine and
good timing.
Food. And, so.
All right, so brief stint in Copenhagen, then tell me what happened.
I was in Vermont for a little bit, but mostly just figuring out what was next. And I cooked a couple kind of like pop-up or guest chef dinners. And Dustin Wilson was at one, and he was a managing partner at this restaurant in San Francisco and recruited me to go out and be the chef there.
Which restaurant?
It's called Mason Pacific.
And Dustin's involvement was he was helping them with the wine, or was he a partner?
He was a kind of like managing partner.
Yeah. Did he have the wine store out there by then, or this preceded that?
He was working on it.
He was?
Yeah.
Okay. So to my research, you get some pretty good notoriety there, getting in, when it closed and all that.
Yeah.
How long were you there?
Oh, less than a year.
And is San Francisco a place that you loved, or just you didn't have
I always liked the Bay Area, and it was a nice. I actually missed our one year in DC, but
right. What
that was before that.
Right. Wait, DC preceded.
Yeah, it was after Copenhagen, before
San Francisco. What was the DC place?
I was cooking at a place called Rose's Luxury, and then I was working front of house at a place called Ripple.
DC is an interesting market.
Yeah.
You know, not like many other markets.
No.
So you go to DC to Maison Pacific. Why do you leave there after a year?
It was just not the right fit at Maison Pacific, and I wasn't sure how the restaurant was going to move forward, and it ended up closing not long after I left. So
really?
Yeah.
So I'm your high school guidance counselor, and I'm sitting with you, and I'm looking at your, not resume, but whatever, and I'm like, Max, there may be a problem here. You seem to be bouncing around a lot.
Yeah.
Why is that? Is that typical of getting starting in the business and getting your sea legs?
I think all of the experiences I had were kind of important in getting me to where I was going, and it was just kind of figuring out where and what I would be doing.
And you left on your terms?
Yes.
You know, it wasn't like you got thrown out or you were stealing or you were a crappy cook or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at that point, it's unusual to be that young, to be somewhere for many years. But Pistot out of the chute was a pretty good run for 3 years.
It was.
And it wasn't, great. I mean, you didn't shut down because of economics. You just.
No.
Yeah. So it wasn't that either.
Yeah.
All right. So we're up to the closing of Maison Pacific. What happens after that?
My girlfriend, who was then, by the time I left San Francisco, was my fiance. We went to Vermont. A friend of mine was opening a wine bar, and he wanted some help. So, we helped him open, basically. He had owned a very successful retail shop.
Right. What's it? Dedalus?
Dedalus, yeah.
Yeah.
And then.
Still there?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, it's a highly regarded.
Yeah, you know, and expanding. Location. And
yeah.
But yeah, he just needed some help to get the wine bar open. That was 2017, maybe.
Okay.
All
right, so let's rapidly move into the current. So you do that, you get him off the ground.
Yeah.
You know it's kind of a stopover to help him. What's on your mind and where do you go?
We had a friend of my wife's reach out, a guy who owned a restaurant and bakery in Austin, Texas. She's from Texas. He had kind of his upper management team kind of were all moving on at the same time. And so he called Corinne and, asked if we would come help him out.
Both of you?
Yeah.
And was it mostly a bakery or a bakery restaurant?
They did a decent amount of wholesale business, but the restaurant was open, you know, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. seven days a week.
How long do you do that?
Just over a year. And then I got into wine sales down there.
So your crossover to wine happened down in Texas in Austin?
Kind of the full move. I always kind of like...
What's the reason? You knew the bakery bread thing was, you know, not permanent.
Yeah.
Do you meet somebody or are you looking? I mean, because this is kind of a big move.
Right. Well, a friend of mine, or, you know, I moved down and one of the guys who I became very close with owned a import and distribution company, so... He and I had been talking and, you know, he needed a little bit of help and I was looking to kind of make the jump over and it was a good way for me to do it.
When you say you're going to make the jump over, at that point you realize I've kind of done enough.
Yeah.
In the kitchens and restaurants, wine kind of juices me. Let me think about, was he just distributing wine in the state or the region or was he importing stuff into the country or?
Just distributing in Texas,
Did you go with him because your sensibilities matched his? You like the kind of wine?
Generally, yeah.
Okay.
And he had a very strong portfolio.
And so you're in sales?
Yep.
So you're doing retail and restaurants, on-premise and all that?
Yeah.
Did any regrets? Like, wait, what am I doing here? I'm a sales guy.
No, I mean, I knew that probably wasn't what I was going to be doing forever, but I was able to work with, you know, a lot of great wine and, you know, work with
accounts,
restaurants, and
people
retail.
That you're familiar with what they do all day.
Right, exactly.
Does that lead to Roberta's or anything in between?
That was the last thing I did before Roberta's.
Okay. So you told me off air you were in California at the Roberta's there.
Yeah.
What year was that?
End of 2019 is when we moved there.
Okay.
I started with Roberta's in 2020.
And Culver City, how old was it, that one? It was fairly new, right?
Yeah, it was less than 2 years at that point, maybe.
Kind of hit the ground running, right?
Yeah. I mean,
it seemed like that whole neighborhood, right. Culver City, the workspace, Wes Adams, all that. There was a lot of good stuff there.
Definitely.
So you're out there. There's a guy in New York, I guess with the title. He leaves. Mm-hmm. Is that the opportunity for you to step up?
That was, yeah.
And that was November of 2020?
November 2020 is when I was with... I moved in June of last year.
Right.
So
2020 was California.
Yeah.
Got it. And in June of last year, which is about a year ago.
Yeah, exactly.
You come to Roberta's Bushwick.
Yeah. I think my wife and I landed a year ago today.
And you're the wine director.
Mm-hmm.
I'll ask you this now. I was going to ask you later. Roberta's is expanding into Montauk. They have Culver City. They have these pop-ups and all of that. Are you working with wine for all those locations?
I am, yeah.
So whatever you see in any of those places, your hand is, you're touching that, which is very cool. You know, there's some ambitious stuff there. All right, so that brings us up to current. Interesting to see a food guy, you know, morph into, you know, a wine guy. Kind of subtle.
Yeah.
You know, you get called down to Texas, you know, help a guy out you knew it was going to end, and then, you know, you're selling wine. All right, so... let me ask you a bunch of general things, and then we'll talk about Roberta's. Was there any person that influenced your interest in food? I mean, was it anything at home at the table? Was it a college friend, you know, that you... you know, where did this food thing come from? Was it self?
Hard to say. I think a lot of it came from me, but my mom's also a pretty good cook, and, you know, she's never spent a long time working in restaurants. But there was a period. A long time ago.
Like a waitress, diner waitress.
No, she was. I mean, I think she maybe waited tables some, and then cooked a little bit. But it was mostly like, I think it was up in like Westchester County, and like at a friend's place. She worked for a bit.
So it sounds somewhat internal and organic.
Yeah.
You know, there was no great force.
No, it was a slow transition. Yeah.
And then, you know, the trail after that was pretty significant, as we discussed.
Right.
You talked about, and I said we'll talk about it a little later, you talked about when one of your last jobs before you got here was in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about helping a friend out down there and then taking a job in wine sales. When did you realize, and I think it was before that, when did you realize that wine was an important part of what interested you and, you know, maybe in the back of your mind, something I want to do? I mean,
I think it happened fairly early on. I obviously fell into food, and that led to restaurants, and restaurants, wine is involved, so... I mean, I didn't even drink alcohol till I was almost 22.
Why? Smoked a lot of pot?
No. I stayed away from everything.
It just wasn't a thing that was around you.
It was a thing to a degree that wasn't healthy for a lot of my family. So I think I just like naturally.
Okay. All right. That's
all right. So my parents are constantly shocked at the fact that I, you know, am working in wine and managing it.
No negatives there.
Right.
When you talked about Pisto, you said not you got into wine.
Yeah. That's where it like hit kind of full force.
Right. I mean, you put your neck out there to put, you know, select wines, put it together, compatible to the food, you know.
Yeah. My partner had been doing it for, you know, the first 6 or 8 months, and eventually we had a conversation and it was like, you seem a lot more interested in this and ambitious with it. So
did you guys have similar likings?
I think so. I obviously, you know, took a deeper dive into figuring out exactly what I wanted out of the program and what I loved. And
all right, so that's an interesting moment to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's early in your career. That precedes San Francisco, big city, D.C., big city, L.A., and all of that.
Yeah, I still did a lot of cooking after that.
Yeah. What what were you thinking wine-wise? What did you know? I mean, what were you exposed to? Vermont doesn't have the exposure to wines that you can get here in New York or San Fran.
Not all of it, but...
some cool stuff.
Yeah, and it was growing at that point already. And as I mentioned, I mean, we talked about Daedalus, but when we just spoke about it, that was kind of like their expansion, but their previous location was around the corner from Bistou. And they brought in a lot of wine that wasn't being sold in most of Vermont.
So that had a...
definitely had an impact.
Like, did you know that you were leaning toward... Or here, I'm making a statement. I mean to ask a question. Were you interested in natural wines? Were small producers, you know, well-thought-out wines were what you were interested in? Did you realize that, or you didn't realize it, but you knew they were making good wines?
I think I realized that pretty early on. Okay. And, I wasn't 100%. Natural wine at that point, but right. But always well-made wine. And, you know, it was, you know, the Kermit Lynch and Louis Dresner and Rosenthal book. And then I kind of like...
the first and good guys.
Found even ZRS at that point.
Jenny and Francois, those guys.
So,
Bowler, to some extent.
But all of that was available up in Vermont and toured... greater degree because of Daedalus, and you know, they bought a lot of
wine. And I think
wine.
Proximity, a lot of these guys realized, you know, we could expand the business to Massachusetts, Vermont, which is a good thing,
right?
I mean, a good break for Vermont.
Yeah. And they started coming up and they wanted to go out to good restaurants, and luckily they often chose to come to mine. So,
I'm curious about when you jumped into the business, you worked at all levels, you know, we're talking almost 10 years ago, a decade or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen things change substantially? I mean, and I'm talking about throw in the pandemic.
Sure.
I'm talking about the way workers are treated. I'm talking about the environment. I mean, like, for instance, at Pistot, did you have an opportunity to create an environment that you thought was right, or you didn't have time to think about it and it was too early in the game?
We were trying.
You were aware.
And, you know, I feel like I always tried to be a good boss, you know, whatever that meant.
Be nice.
To me. Yeah, give people what they ask for.
That's important.
I was, you know, send people home when they're sick.
So you had a fair sense of, because you know that doesn't always exist everywhere.
Right. But that always felt right to me.
Is not being that way one of the parts of what's wrong with this business?
I mean, obviously, it's my inclination to work that way, and it's the way I want to be treated. So I think that's, I think most people would probably benefit from being that way. Obviously, it gets difficult at times, and, you know, it's not like...
Because the horror stories you hear because of the pandemic and the light it's shone on, you know, the industry.
Right.
I think people were just fed up. And
the
restaurant owners, companies got away with it.
Yeah.
And
a lot of people now are realizing that they don't have to do the work.
So that's a good thing.
You're definitely seeing
change.
Yeah. I mean, it makes it difficult to keep the same number of restaurants in New York City or anywhere else, really, but... and keep them fully staffed. But
listen,
figure it out.
A lot of people that grace these microphones left the floor.
Yes.
And a lot of them
took
jobs in the industry, and some left the industry for various reasons. Age, too much work, couldn't take it anymore.
Right.
You know, that type of stuff. So you started here in New York kind of in the middle of COVID, right?
Yeah.
Kind of an uneasy time.
Right. Yeah.
You know, open, close, June of last year was a little crazy, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we've gone through a couple of shutdowns and trying to navigate what to do with everybody and how to keep the business operating at some level. Luckily, we sell a lot of pizza, so.
And you were able to weather that storm.
Yeah, but
I mean, this is a destination.
Sure.
For a physical location for the product.
Right, right.
People are not going to forget Roberta. If they go under, then it's going to be tough for other people.
But I mean, I definitely had a couple of months in Culver City where I was, you know, sitting in front of delivery tablets and packing pizza in boxes.
You and almost everyone else in the business. So the list here at Roberta's is, I don't know, to me, it's small family, natural wine producers,
sure.
You know, an interesting list.
Yeah.
We talked about this, but tighten it up for me. I mean, when was that moment that the commitment to natural wines, you know, was forged in your mind? It's like, this is what I like. This is what I'd like to turn people on to.
Right.
There's a lot of other stuff there. There's enough of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think I started tasting it fairly early on in my career with wine.
To Pistot and the retailer and all that. Right.
And was kind of drawn to it then.
What was the draw? Because those days could have been funky, could have been inconsistent.
Right, right.
You know, still today, but not as much. I mean,
maybe I was lucky to be 25 and
didn't give
open
a crap.
And
What was the draw? I mean, was it the story, the practices?
Some of it was the story. I really appreciated the practices. I mean, we bought organic produce and we worked with good farmers locally and, you know, we went to visit their farms and saw how they were working, and that was just a part that was important to me, and so that kind of translated in wine, I think.
It's a good point, because if you're in the restaurant business, you talk to customers and they bust balls about provenance.
Right.
You know, what farm, what practices, you know, and then they order like Mayomi or something. You know, it's like, wait a second.
Yeah, there's some disconnect there.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a good education and a shift towards that.
Yeah.
So that happens early on and you commit to it, like you keep your eyes focused.
I think it's
on the expansion of producers, regions.
Right. And I think it kind of continues to be reinforced. And I spent a lot of time in Montreal and the natural wine scene is very strong there.
Crazy.
Traveling. I mean, Copenhagen, obviously. Anytime I was in France, that I was kind of like drawn to restaurants that supported the same producers and. Yeah.
So Vermont was fairly close to Canada.
Yeah.
I had David McMillan on from Joe Beef.
Yes.
I don't think he's with them anymore. He bought a farm.
He's living his life.
Yeah.
Living the life he's dreamed of.
He actually doesn't drink anymore.
I know.
Thing.
But he makes wine.
Yeah. But he kind of laid out the wine scene there pretty eloquently.
Right, right.
And
as
what was
does.
Wrong with the restaurant business. You know, a very colorful guy. So that was fun. All right, Max, we have to take a quick break.
Sure.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about Roberta's, the wine program, a bunch of other things. We got the wine list, and we have what looks like some delicious wine in front of us to taste. We're talking to Max McKinnon. Max is the wine director at Roberta's right here in Bushwick, right where the Heritage Radio Network studios are. We'll be right back.
I'm Chava Perivan, co-host of Agave Road Trip on HRN, here to talk about 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. From the blue agave they grow to their recycled glass bottle, 818 emphasizes the earth's importance in all they do. Their distillery runs on biomass and solar power, which means they don't rely as much on fossil fuels and are able to reduce their carbon footprint. Their labels, corks, and boxes are all certified by the Forest Stewardship Council as coming from sustainably managed forests. 818 is a proud member of 1% for the Planet, through which they support HRN as well as Sacred, my organization in Jalisco, where together we transform agave byproducts and water waste into adobe bricks that are donated to local infrastructure projects, like a local library in Zapotitlán de Vadillo. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their sustainability efforts and find 818 near you. 818 has been part of so many magical nights for me, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York. 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Max McKinnon. Max is the wine director for Roberta's Pizza all over the place. Let's tick it off, Max. There's Roberta's Culver City. There's an opening in Montauk.
Yeah, it's open.
There's Domino Park.
There is.
Is there anything in like Tennessee? No.
Not yet. There's a pop-up.
Pop-up.
Yeah, it's been a long-standing pop-up.
What's that cowboy pop-up? Was that upstate? Or is that...
That's in Nashville.
That's Nashville. Yeah. Okay. Anywhere else that...
And there's a permanent space that is set for, you know, sometime.
Okay.
As soon as it comes together.
Okay.
There's Houston, but it's a counter service spot. There's a little bit of wine there, but it's in a fun location. And then same in Chicago.
Right. And then you're in like urban space or something.
Yeah.
In Manhattan.
Yeah.
You know, there's accessibility to that.
We send a little wine there too, just so people can enjoy a glass if they choose to do so.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I got a couple of questions that'll be a good setup for talking about the wine program at Roberta's. I'm curious your thoughts and take on some regions, producers, wines that are exciting you right now.
Yeah.
I know it changes. I know it could be seasonal.
Right.
But what's top of mind to you?
Oh, I'm always kind of drawn old world, so... we're going to drink something from the Auvergne, but it's not necessarily something that's new. It's a producer I've supported for a long time, but I don't know. I've been excited to see a lot of the kind of young winemakers in Burgundy, whether they buy a little property or whether they're working as a negosiate, and are kind of like finding vineyards that are farmed well, or they're converting the farming themselves. And
so that's like the anti-Burgundy. It's
right.
Young.
Yeah.
They're looking for property that isn't, you know, crazy expensive or
exactly.
Unavailable. I heard a little of that's going on in Germany, too.
Yeah.
You know, where you could pick up property and the younger guys are trying to make wine.
Right.
That's interesting. Can you think of, our listeners always like to hear some recos. Can you think of a couple of people that are doing
yeah.
that?
I think Domaine Didon is a small producer that I've...
Spell.
D-I-D-O-N.
D-I-D-O-N.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a guy, Jonathan Purcell, making wine under the Vin Noé label. He has a few...
So V-I-N? Vin?
And then N-O-E.
L-L-E? Or N-O-E-L?
N-O-E.
Oh, N-O-A.
Yeah.
No.
N-O-A, yeah. It's got a little accent.
Yeah.
he's from like just outside of San Diego and is making wine in Burgundy now, but.
Yeah, I read about an American in Burgundy.
Yeah.
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 But
they're all.
So you hit it on the nose. Those are traditional places, but you like the new play. What about any other regions, you know, that are not as traditional? Let me set you up on this.
Sure.
I know because I I've had these guys on the show a bunch of times. I know you were at Caractere. How do you pronounce it?
I think Caractere.
Yeah. Caractere.
Yeah.
Marco Kovach.
Yeah.
I know you went out to do that. There's an exposure to a wide range of winemakers.
Yeah.
So two things. Explain what it is and, you know, who it's there. And,
right.
And tell me if there was anybody there or any regions that...
It was a kind of a natural wine fair outside of Vienna. It was the 9th one. Marco's been doing it for a while now. But yeah, and I think it gets bigger.
Who participates?
Winemakers focused in Central Europe.
Okay.
I mean, maybe Rob.
So the specialty is...
Yeah,
I mean, a couple guys sneak in or out.
Yeah.
And roaming the floor on that, do you walk away with an oh my god on a couple of wines?
There was some really great wine there, so it was a fun thing to see. Not all of it in the U.S., but a lot of it.
Anything that you're going to bring back to Roberta's?
Yeah, and we actually work with some of the producers who are there already. So
yeah, I know Zev CRS is heavily involved with those guys.
Yeah, Crescio's got a works with Zev, and he
Crescio's Yeah, Crescio's wines are amazing.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about Roberta's.
Yeah.
So that there's some cool things. I think Marco mentioned something about doing something in New York in October.
Yeah, it's October and November, but it's going to be in Midtown, I believe.
Yeah.
Which would be
He had sent me a note, so that'll be interesting. Yeah. We'll talk to him.
Kind of a different vibe. Out in the country and in Austria.
You're not going to Stephanie and Edward's house, in Manhattan. Yeah. You're going to some funky wine bar or whatever. All right, so let's talk about Roberta's. Like I said, they're known for a tight, natural wine list.
Yeah.
Not huge, not small. So you get here, and there are people that preceded you that all, were sincere about, the type of wines that should be on the list.
Yeah.
You get here, you look at the list. What do you do? I mean, what do you bring to the game? Do you delete? Do you add?
I think everybody who's worked here probably has areas that they lean more towards or producers that they, want to bring and support.
So go with areas first. What's the lean that you bring in?
I mean, I don't think it's anything too crazy, but I probably buy more French wine than anything.
Okay. That makes sense to me that French was not, knowing the people that were here.
Yeah.
And if you're talking about maybe getting some of those Burgundy guys and we're going to taste something, that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
Tell me about the wine list. How big?
Right now it's maybe 60 to 65 wines, but it's just a selection of what we have.
So it's 65 on the menu, but there's more floating around.
Yeah.
You take stuff off, put stuff on.
Right. I think it makes it a little easier for most of our guests to not be flipping through a book and to order a bottle of wine.
Is it harder to curate a smaller, tighter list than to blow out a big list?
I think so, but I'm lucky to not have to, sell something before I can buy something else. We have a decent sized cellar, so we just have stuff that's ready to go on.
Can you get the wines that you want? I mean, it's kind of a silly question because if you can't get it in New York, but I think the question is less availability. What am I trying to say? It's more that things have become so popular and, they're rationed that you can't get what you want anymore.
Right,
is that a thing now?
It's definitely a thing.
Like, what's the wine Frank Cornelissen makes? Susakara? Yeah. I mean, everybody loves it.
For a while, that was...
You couldn't get it, right?
Yeah. There are also smaller producers that are even more difficult to,
Does that drive you crazy, or you just move on?
It's all right. There's plenty of wine out there. And if they give us two bottles of something or three bottles of something, you can take it.
So you don't feel there's something you have to have so bad it'll drive you crazy?
Not really.
Kind of move on?
I always understand. If I ask for something and they say, sorry, you can't have it, then I'm like,
okay. I mean, that's a healthy way to do it.
I don't blame you for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had Justin Chernow from Four Horsemen on.
Yeah.
I mean, there's stuff that he was able to get and that he loved that he can't get.
Yeah.
He's not going to obsess over it anymore. You know, it's just sometimes he throws his arms up.
Yep.
You know, it's like, why is this happening now? Yeah. You know, why am I getting screwed on all of this?
Exactly.
The list skews globally, I guess. I guess there was a little less French. You brought a little more French to it. But what are we looking at? You know, next thing is Italian because Roberta's is...
Yeah. I think a lot of Italian wines make a lot of sense with the food here. And people are always looking for it. So
they kind of lean towards that.
Yeah.
I'm in an Italian-focused restaurant.
Right. Although there are some producers, for whatever reason, that we, like Trico, we sell... kind of whenever it's on a list, it's one of the first things to go.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yeah.
I think price point helps out.
And people who know
know
that they're not going to see it everywhere.
Right.
And if
they
don't buy it, it won't be here in 2 weeks.
Yeah. And it's not prohibitively expensive. So
no.
It's,
I think your customers come to know that, you know, they don't have to or want to pay for a ton of money. I mean,
right.
This is not the most expensive meal.
Yeah.
You throw a pizza, a couple of things together.
Sure.
You're getting out of here. All right. I have to ask you, it's a little hokey, but I have to ask you the eternal wine question.
All right.
For you in your current state. And that's, what wines go with pizza? Wine. So I know that toppings, just like if you make something with a sauce, you almost have to pair to a sauce and the steak itself or whatever. All right, so what goes with pizza? Let's start with a plain margarita. Just give me top of your mind what you think the best play is.
Oh, that's such a tough question. We've been selling a lot of like fun, lighter Grenache.
Goes well?
Yeah, I think so.
What is it about Grenache? It has enough acidity or not too heavy, not too light?
Right, when it's treated in a light way, I think it still has some serious fruit quality. It still has, but like, I don't know, it's something about aromatics.
So give me a bottle of Grenache that would be good with a margarita pizza. Can you think of something?
With a margarita pizza.
All right, we'll come back to that. When it comes to your mind, you say, oh, here's the one. All right, but Roberta's is famous for the bee sting. Now you have a pizza with some spicy supersod. There's a little honey on it.
Yeah.
What's good with that?
That one's always tough for me.
Is it?
Yeah.
So what do you settle on? Because
it's
too
spicy.
Much going on.
There's
sweet.
It's like there's
so
tomato
what's
sauce.
Safe? Like a Chianti Classico or not even?
I think drink what you like, but maybe Montepulciano.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's a good one. It's got a little body
for
the meat. Pizza's a little oily.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like it matches the level of intensity or can.
Yeah. I won't torture you. I'll give you one more. A white pizza. A pizza with no red sauce. With or without clams. You know, sometimes it's just mozzarella or a little ricotta or whatever.
Yeah.
Does that push you to white wines or not necessarily?
It does for me, but that's
what's good.
Not
with
necessarily
that?
For everybody. Chenin Blanc. I think it has a, at least, you know, maybe a richer style.
You're preaching to the choir.
It can, I mean, it has it can be fuller bodied. It can have
diversity.
And it's great with cheese, so.
You made our friend Pascaline very happy saying that. All right, so we talked a little about it. What are some of the better values on the wine list? I mean, not always necessarily the specific wine, but like is Grenache a good value?
Generally, I mean,
yeah.
It depends.
If you want a good wine and you're looking for a good value, I guess it crosses everything over. I mean, you think of anything specifically?
Aligoté. Yeah.
So you get to hit Burgundy.
Yeah. And
you get to taste, and the quality is there.
Yeah, but it's always at a slightly lower price point.
Yeah, that's a good one. Most interesting and funky wine on the list? Something that you know is, like, this is a bomb in whatever way?
In a, I mean, Let's see. We can go with something rare and expensive. We go with Timothy Strobel's Coteau Champenois Rosé.
So Coteau Champenois is the still wine of Champagne?
Yeah.
And it's a rosé?
Yeah, and I think so, there's not much of it out there. But, yeah. It's a bit of a... It's for a certain person coming in to drink something that's hard to get and is interesting. And
is it super expensive because of the rarity, or it's not that crazy?
It's pretty expensive.
It is pretty expensive.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is both the rarity thing and I think where it comes from, also.
All right. Those are good ones. All right. Max, so that's the wine list at Roberta, but like we tell everybody, that if you don't know what you want or like, just tell people what you're thinking.
Yeah.
What you want to spend, what you like, tell them what you're ordering.
Yeah.
That's what Max is here for. He's not here to upsell you.
You should never be uncomfortable telling somebody how much you want to spend.
Yeah, and Max is that kind of guy, believe me. But you should feel that way about any wine person, whether it's retail or in a restaurant. All right, Max, we don't let anybody leave the Grape Nation without answering our wine list. Five questions. Everybody's asked the same five questions.
I should have studied.
You shouldn't study. Spontaneity is really what makes this fun. We post your answers on social media because guys like you who toil over this really find some good wines, and we want to hear what you're saying. So two things. We're going to start it, but I think we should pour a little of this wine and drink it before our segment, and then we could talk about it. So this is the Tricot Pinot Noir Rosé. You'll tell me a little more about it.
Sure.
When we do the wine sip. All right, you ready for, maybe you need to take a gulp of this for the wine list? I'm going to take a sip of this. It's kind of a beautiful, almost like coppery red.
Yeah.
That's good. Wow, that's good.
Nice.
Really good. All right, Max, here we go. Wine list, five questions. First question, you may have answered this, during the interview, but tighten it up a little for me. What are you drinking now? What's in your fridge at home? What are you trying? Do the seasons change what you were drinking and what you're drinking now? Is your wife bringing stuff home? What's a couple things?
A couple things. I drink a lot of Burgundy and Jura.
That's your preference.
Yeah, and then the stuff that my wife does not bring home that I love to drink is Syrah. So
a couple things.
Yeah.
Tell me about a couple of specific things in the Jura that you like.
There is a lot.
I know.
So,
any whites, reds?
Both. I mean, I like kind of like richer style whites. Sometimes, as long as the acidity is there and, it's got some tension to it, but...
Is that hard to find? A rich white that has the acidity and the tension?
Not in the Jura.
Right.
It's easier.
That's why you go there.
Yeah. And then, I drink a lot of lighter style reds, so...
Yeah, that's a good region for that.
Yeah.
What else? You said Syrah, your wife. Are we talking Rhone or what are we talking...
Yeah.
What are we talking there? Saint Joseph, Cornas?
I kind of, get into all of it.
Any particular producers?
I mean, Gonon's a favorite of mine.
He was on the show. It was a dream to put him on the show.
Yeah,
he's a wonderful guy.
I got to visit and hang out, and, he's one of the people I'm still in touch with.
He's very
from the
gracious.
Region. Yeah. So.
What's a little sad, and sort of like Burgundy was, the wines were somewhat accessible and reasonable, and now here's what you pay. And
I look at what it cost on the list at Piste Du.
Yeah.
It's a different time.
Yeah. He's a special wine maker.
Yeah.
All right. Those are good answers. All right. This is the goofiest question on the wine list, but I'm going to make you answer it. Favorite wine and food pairing? Not what you think is a good pairing or what you'd recommend. What do you like? Obviously, you're not eating it every night, every month.
Yeah, sure.
But what's that? Wow, this works.
I mean,
You're not allowed to say champagne and oysters on this show.
No, so. It's definitely like Northern Roncerat and Braised Lamb Shank. But
and why does that work? A little gaminess of the lamb.
Yeah, and the like pepperiness of the wine.
Full-bodied.
Yeah, full-bodied. I mean, I drink mostly light reds, but you know, then you know that, yeah, that pairing for
that's
me
like
is something.
That's like the opposite end.
I can eat it probably more than most things.
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, that is kind of a perfect pairing.
Yeah.
When you think about it.
I think so.
Yeah, good one.
Yeah.
All right, third question. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? Now, I know we went through a pandemic, things were closed, people didn't go out. I know you work your ass off, you bump around a little, Montauk, California here, sure, whatever. But I think when you come in here, there's a guy, Max, who's put a thoughtful list together. If you talk to him, he'll guide you. The list is cool. The vibe is great. What's like, where do you go or you know of that, you know, embraces all of that? Anywhere. LA's, you know, whatever.
I mean, we talked about Montreal.
Yes.
And I'm ashamed to say that I've not been to Mont Lapin yet.
Is that Vanya?
Yeah, but Vanya and Marco, yeah. But we used to go to Vin Papillon a fair amount when they were still there.
So Montreal wine scene, is there anything like that around here? Do you go out much?
I go out a fair amount when I can. You know?
Let's think about, you know, where.
Let's see.
By not mentioning someone doesn't mean you forgot them.
No, of course.
These are just places that you...
Yeah. I mean, I love the Four Horsemen. Talk about...
Can't go wrong with that.
Yeah. The wine list and the food kind of to match it.
They've really come into a stride. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's arguably one of the most interesting restaurants.
Yeah. I remember going and seeing Justin there right before they opened and like walking around the space, and I did not know what it would turn into, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to get into now.
Yeah.
All right. Those are good ones. All right. Fourth question. Favorite all-time wine? When I put this question on the list, hear me out here. When I put the question on the list, my intention was sort of, all right, I got Max across from me. Let me see the rarest, most expensive wine he ever drank. You know, he's in the business. I can give a crap about that.
Yeah.
What's the wine or a few wines that were enlightening, that were gateways, that changed the way you thought about it? It had to be starting a Pistol along the road where there were a few wines that solidified your love of wine, natural wine, you know, all of that. Can you think of a couple things?
Probably.
No, you have to right now. Remember I told you, spontaneity?
Yeah. I mean, I was lucky enough to drink a handful of bottles of Thierry Allemand Reynard. Back in that day, it was also, you know, we got allocated a fair amount of it. And,
so you love Syrah. You know, he epitomizes.
Right. And I think that was kind of, somehow that was the beginning of my Northern Roncerat kind of like journey.
Right.
Started there. So
when you tasted it, it hit right away.
Yeah.
Right? Like this is. Can you think of anything else like that?
I'm trying to think of like the producers in the Jura who like. I mean,
was there somebody early on that, you know, opened you up to the Jura? Can you think of anything?
I mean, probably just the great number of producers that are doing things that are exciting.
Yeah.
You know, you could name drop the rare and now expensive ones, but
That's sad too.
You know, but I was still, I mean, even like the Baron Foss wines I was drinking, you know, back at Pistou and love those and.
Yeah, so we come back to the Jura again.
Yeah, and there are producers that are newer to me now, but...
All right, those are good ones.
Yeah.
All right, last question. You're almost at the finish line. You'll get across alive. and I think you should be able to handle this question pretty well. Recommend to me the best wine retail for around $15, $20, $22. I need you to recommend a red. I need you to recommend a white. You can do producer. You could do regions, like regions. Muscadet is pretty good value in that price range.
Yeah,
15, some good producer.
15 to 20, $22.
Here's the setup every time.
Yeah.
My kids are a little younger than you. They can't show up at a dinner party with a crappy supermarket wine.
Yeah.
They're not spending $40, $50 on a gift.
Right.
That just adds up. So they're looking for that wow wine for $18, $20, $22. What comes to mind?
I mean, I think I always lean French, as we've talked about, but I'm trying to think of regions where you can. It's getting tough now.
Yes. The reds, with this question, the reds tend to be tougher than the whites.
Yeah.
But Max, we must dig here. And we must come up with a record.
You can always find some like Grelot or Pinot Donis for, you know.
Can you get those in that price range?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Those are very interesting wines. Grelot is GROLLEAU.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the varietal.
Yeah.
And Pinot Donis, Pinot, D'AUNIS.
Yes.
Okay. So those are two varietals that you should look for. Is Grelot white?
No, red.
It's red, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking of something else. All right, so that's the reds. Let's think white.
I mean, you can probably find a few bottles of Aligoté that are still in that kind of like $20 range.
I think so.
I think it's a good place to look.
Yeah.
If you're in Burgundy, it's probably getting a little more expensive than that. But
so take a minute to explain what Aligoté is. It's in Burgundy. It's an area, where is it? North of where? Just set that up for me. So
yeah.
People, because it's worth seeking out and the more people know about
it. Sure. I mean, you see a decent amount of it in Burgundy, but you know, it's a great variety you can find elsewhere too. But it's not, it doesn't kind of develop as much richness or fruit as Chardonnay, but I think grown in the right soils and treated right, it creates sometimes
it hits a
very
lot of
interesting
the notes.
Wines, yeah.
Where it's grown in other places besides Burgundy?
Yeah.
Like?
I mean, you can grow it in California.
Yeah. I mean Dan Petrosky's growing Rimbola.
yeah, right.
You could grow mostly anything somewhere. All right, so Aligoté for the white. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Anything else come to mind?
I mean, it's hard. I rarely buy
a lot of white.
Or $20 bottles retail. It's,
yeah.
I have to like convert from what we pay at the restaurant.
Yeah, so what's a good value white that you serve here that you think is? Think about it.
Yeah.
What's the varietal?
I mean, we try and pour Chenin Blanc by the glass, so that anything we pour by the glass will be like $20 on a retail shelf or something like that.
So Chenin again.
Yeah.
Good call.
Yeah. It's my wife's favorite grape too, so.
Is it?
It's around a lot.
And the interesting you said earlier was the diversity of styles.
Yeah.
Sweet, dry, in between.
Right.
And different makers. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
All right. Good job there.
Eh.
Had to pull a couple things out of you, but I ain't letting you out of here until I get the answers. All right. Our last segment of the show is called the Weekly Wine Sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. It's a great opportunity, as I mentioned to you, if a winemaker comes in to taste their wine, or when you have somebody like you who painstakingly, you know, looks at all these wines and makes the selections. I asked if you didn't mind to pull a wine out that you like. That's cool, that's reasonable, that's accessible, meaning some way, somehow, you know, you could find it. So we're tasting the Tricot Pinot Noir Rosé.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about the wine, the maker, the region,
vintage. Yeah, the vintage is 2020. It's Les Trois Bonhommes, and so it's 100% Pinot Noir that they vinify as a rosé. There are a couple making wine in the Auvergne. I think they've got 5 hectares or so. And they've been making wine there since 2003. Uh-huh. Yeah, they took over.
And what type of farming practices?
All organic.
It's all organic.
Yeah, the property they took over actually was organic since the early 70s. And,
so
and
it has
they,
good
they
hybrid.
Kind of kept it that way.
Because yeah. It's the opposite. After the war, everybody killed everything,
right.
And they had to bring it back.
Yeah.
So they were lucky to walk into that.
Yeah. So
and minimal cellar
yes.
intervention.
I mean, I think in 2003, they made some wine without sulfur, and they haven't added sulfur to wine in over 10 years, which is crazy because I think they're talented enough to do it. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Where are you at with sulfur? Occurs naturally.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to put a little in. I mean,
yeah.
You're not obsessed that if there's any sulfur in it,
no.
It's over?
No. I do drink wine with sulfur in it.
Okay.
You know, I think you can make amazing wine without it. I think
that's
sometimes,
proven of late.
Sometimes you'll end up ruining wine if you are too dogmatic to...
Right.
To add sulfur when something's going wrong. But
all right, so let's talk.
Minimal's good.
I think,
you know.
I mean, done right by the right people.
Yeah.
You know what they need to do.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk more about this wine. So it is a rosé of 100% Pinot Noir.
Yes.
What do we know about the winemaking? Is it whole cluster? Is it?
It is not.
Okay.
I believe it is direct press. Into fiberglass tanks.
Huh.
Yeah.
And to make a rosé like this, how long do we think they keep it on the skins?
Not long.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a medium color one.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm going to pour myself a little more.
Yeah.
Because we're going to do an evaluation. Because this seems like a very cool wine. I know I'm off mic, but... You think I know by now? All right, so Max, let's look at the color. Sort of a pinky, coppery, you know, not light, not dark, but really a beautiful, I mean, it's a beautiful color, right?
Yeah.
It's fairly clear, you know.
Definitely.
You know,
for being unfined and unfiltered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very clear to that point. All right, so let's go nose. Put it under that schnoz. And I suck at this. What do you get on the nose? Kind of an interesting nose. Tell me the descriptors you get.
I mean, I think you get enough of that kind of ripe fruit that people love in a lot of rosé. You know,
there's something on top besides the fruit. I can't figure out
no,
what
I
that is.
I think what I love about this and what I love in a lot of rosé are kind of the slightly more savory elements. There's definitely
there's a savory...
Like this
as a general
quality,
yep.
You know, it's like.
All right, so let's go mouthfeel. When people drink rosé, you know, they're thinking kind of a lighter wine or whatever. That's not the case. People don't know rosé the way we know rosé.
Right.
So when you throw this over the tongue, it's got a nice medium.
Yeah.
It's not a thin wine.
It's definitely more medium bodied.
Yeah,
Which
is, it's nice. I mean, it's got some nice body.
It coats your palate. It's got some substance to it.
Definitely, and it spreads out in the mouth. All right.
Even like a little bit of tannin, but just barely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pinot Noir Rosé, we're talking tannin.
Right.
All right, take another sip and talk to me about the palate and let me know if the palate replicates what you find on the nose too.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the nose translates to the palate on
the red
with this wine.
The savoriness.
Yeah, you definitely get that more kind of like fresh, savory herbs, not dried out in any way.
Where's the acidity on this? Is this a medium acidic wine? Is it low?
I think it's got a decent amount of acidity. Yeah.
It's not vacant of acid.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, in your face, but it's there.
Right.
What's the alcohol on this?
Should be pretty low. Oh, there's 13.
Okay. So you could drink this. All right. Now the other question, which I tortured you with before, is tell me some good food pairings, food, snacks, whatever. I mean, what would be nice with this?
I think a lot of things would be nice with it, but I think...
Max, you can't answer a question like that. You got to be specific. Is it charcuterie? Is it chicken? What?
I think this is good with more kind of like of the vegetable-focused things that we serve here. You know, like? Even just the salads we have, you know.
So salads this would are go
often,
well
It's
with
often
this.
A tough thing to suggest... You know, a wine to drink with salad, but rosé is good for that.
But you're talking like a dressed salad with at least olive oil and some kind of acid.
Yeah.
This on top of it would pair well.
Yeah.
And that's not the easiest thing to pair properly.
Right,
a
exactly.
Salad, you know, the old artichoke and asparagus.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think it's a tough
one. And if you're not going to pour Sauvignon Blanc or something, which we
don't tick off I don't have the bottle in front of me. Tick off the producer, the vintage year and everything. So the wine we tasted today is the Tricot.
Yeah. Marion Vincent Tricot, Les Trois Bonhommes is the name of the cuvée. They make a red as well, but this is the Les Trois Bonhommes Rosé 2020.
And I don't want to put you on the spot, but ballpark retail, do you have any idea? I mean, work backwards.
34, something like that.
So it's... not cheap, not expensive,
right.
But delivers everything
you're
looking for in a better Pinot Noir rosé.
I think so.
It's pretty delicious.
Yeah, and I love supporting their wines. I mean, they don't need it as much as they used to because people are
that's the
after
story.
Their wines. But
we talked about it earlier. Here's a classic example.
It's true.
Right? You just drink it and enjoy it. Then you go to order and it's like you get two bottles.
Yeah.
It's like, what happened?
Yeah.
All right, so that's the Tricot Pinot Noir Rosé. Max, thank you for responding to my request and pulling that out. It's
a
good one.
Yeah.
I appreciate tasting
pleasure.
It.
Pleasure.
And I will post it on our social media so people, you know, are aware of it when they come in here or if they try to look at it.
Yeah, they make amazing light red wine.
People should spend a little more time looking for their wines, go online or, you know, wherever they can get more info.
Right.
All right, Max, we got to wrap up the show. Let me do a quick wrap up, and I want to get some info from you. And then we're out of here. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. I always say that if you subscribe, Max will pop up with all his great recos and his interesting story. So why should you have to chase him down when you can subscribe and they'll be there? Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. I know that's confusing. So you can always go to the hashtag The Grape Nation to find us. As I mentioned, we will post Max's wine list answers on our social media in the coming week. And I will also give you more information on our weekly wine selection, the Tricot Pinot Noir Rosé. Max, if we want to find out more about you and Roberta's, where are good places to go on social media?
Social media, my Instagram is Max, MACK13.
Okay, so that's you could catch up with Max,
and you can find me there
if he's not running somewhere.
It's mostly drinking wine and running.
Well, but that's discovery. You know, you're drinking a wine, and people go, "What's Max drinking?" And that, so that's why I ask people where they can find
her. Sure.
And Roberta's is at Roberta's and online.
Yeah, Roberta's Pizza.
And all that stuff. Just a curiosity. If I go to Roberta's on the internet and I hit website, do I see any of the wine selections or
the wine lists are
so if you've never been here and you like what you're hearing, you can go on and like here's some of the wines or here's the list for now.
Yeah,
that's good to know. All right, Max, It was a pleasure sitting down with you. A pleasure to meet you. I wish you only good luck and success here at Roberta. I'll see you coming in and out of the studio.
Exactly.
Thank you to our guest, Max McKinnon. Max is the wine director at Roberta's. Thank you to our engineer, as always, Armin. And everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben-Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.